Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We are October 23rd, 2019, and I've been very busy, thanks to my friends and especially my donors, financial donors. I'm putting out yet another book, which will be available any day now. It's simply called Ukrainian Nationalism. It's being put together with the assistance of the editorial staff of Russia Insider, whose assistance has been invaluable. But it will be published under Romana Books, that label. Now, the book was begun actually as early as 2012 and really is a patchwork of essays and things that I put together since that time. The only problem, even though this is a work of history, it does not take into consideration what's occurred over the last year with the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Although it does deal with church issues prior to this, throughout the 20th century. So this is not a work of current events. So that's tolerable. Current events at the time are mentioned, which are now history. So, because this book was written over a long period of time, certain things will be, slightly out of date, but the overwhelming bulk of the book is purely history, and it's a understanding of Ukrainian nationalism, roughly from the period of Hetman Mazepa to roughly 2016. It's the longest book I've ever put together. It deals quite a bit with the events of 2014, which of course will change the history of Ukraine forever. One of the overarching theses of the book is that there is a legitimate place for Ukrainian nationalism in the Russian mind, and certainly in the Orthodox mind. That nationalism does not have to be anti-Russian. But also remember something else. So much of the anti-Russian thinking isn't so much, anti-Russia as a nation, but as opposed to the bureaucracy in St. Petersburg. Mazepa got his start making war on Peter the Great, which is certainly an honorable thing. He was right. Peter the Great, of course, was wrong, historically and morally. St. Petersburg is about as Russian as the desk that I'm sitting at. It was put together precisely to be a non-Russian city, with, semi-classical architecture and pagan gods and goddesses everywhere. The church finally talked Peter into taking them down, but only partially. It was, it's a Gnostic, as I said many times, it's a Gnostic project. And of course, so much of the rest of it is against the Soviet Union. One of the great errors of the Ukrainian nationalist movement of all types is their refusal to make a distinction between St. Petersburg and the USSR on the one hand and Russia on the other. You have two revolutions, the St. Petersburg Revolution of the 18th century, and of course, the more famous Bolshevik Revolution. Both created imperial empires. Now, many of the errors of Peter and his successors, with the exception of Elizabeth in the 18th century, especially Catherine II, were corrected in the 19th century. And unfortunately, I think one of Tsar Nicholas II's errors was not moving the capital back to Moscow and rebuilding a Muscovite system of rule. But he did attempt to bring back the much older Muscovite understanding, despite being in Petersburg. He named his son Alexei for a reason. So that's the fundamentals. I mean, as I've said before, Nikolai Gogol, the great Russo-Ukrainian writer, stated that in his Arabesques, which is unfinished work, he had an unfinished work in Ukrainian history, which is really just notes, which I've read in great detail. The thesis seems to be that Ukraine, of course, is a separate nation because it only, you know, most of it was under other empires through most of its history. So it did develop differently. It is more westernized, which in and of itself is not a terrible thing. And of course, the historiography often ignores the medieval state of Galicia, which is a key element. And something I've kind of retracted from my research prior, and in the Third Rome, where I don't mention it. That's, you know, the 19th century view of Russian history that completely skips this. You know, Ukrainian identity came into existence in the sense we use it today, in the Middle Ages, but it developed a very sharp edge in the 17th century in the war between the Orthodox and the Unians. How ironic that in the 20th century the Unions have taken it over and claimed the Ukrainian mantle for themselves, which is a little bizarre since, you know, Ukraine, in modern Ukraine, came into existence precisely in the Orthodox war against the Unions, and the Unions were a foreign imposition. I was a Uniate for a long time. They even married me many years ago, the Ukrainians, and though I learned a lot from them, I left them for several reasons, one of which is that they don't know what they are. There's a reason there's no such thing as a Uniate catechism. I've met hundreds over the years, and some are Orthodox, some are Catholic. It depends on their background. There's Uniate parishes. I know one in McLean, Virginia, where there's a gigantic icon of St. Mark of Ephesus in the priest's rectory. In the church itself, there's a large icon of St. John of Kronstadt. This is the problem that I'm talking about. And I never got a straight answer as to how that could be in a church under Rome. There's no such thing as kind of being half under Rome or sort of under Rome. If you say his name, especially this current disaster of a pope, at the Eucharist, that's, you know, there's no such thing as half communion. So I could make no sense out of it. And of course, one of the worst things of Orthodox ecumenism, and one of the reasons I so vehemently reacted to it, was that this isn't the Rome of the Renaissance or the Middle Ages. They don't have a traditional liturgy anymore. It is one of the most liberal institutions in American and Western societies today. Now, I've gone on about how the child molestation thing is nonsense, that there's very, very few arrests, let alone convictions. The public school system has a worse record than the Church of Rome does. That you should not use against them. It's nonsensical. But there is no tradition. There is no Latin tradition. They don't use Latin anymore. There was a great reaction, which I was a part of back in college, in the Society of St. Pius X and all the rest of it. And it seems to mirror much of what's going on in the Orthodox Church with the old calendar. But ecumenism doesn't make any sense with a church that's nothing like it was 100 years ago. I was an altar boy in the Roman Church in the late 70s and very early 80s, just when that kind of thing was becoming in vogue. But the Catholic Church is extremely liberal in American society and has done quite a bit of damage, especially on immigration. So, and remember too, in Ukraine, up until the old Ruthenian movement, if you go to my website, rusjournal.org, you'll see at the very end, one of the last essays I have on the old Ruthenians, one of the most interesting things to come out of Galicia in a long time. where these units had been completely Latinized. I've seen numerous pictures. You can't tell. There's nothing different between the old Latin and the Uniate churches. And they reacted to this, wanting to use regular iconography and using the iconostas and everything else. They had been completely Latinized. And their reaction to it led people like Ivan Yelmovich to go back to Orthodoxy. One of the old Ruthenians, of course, was also the great Saint Alexei Toth, of Pennsylvania, who, because of the ignorance of Bishop Dwyer, who I believe was in Minnesota, had no choice but to leave the Union. They couldn't maintain the Slavic tradition unless they left the Church of Rome. It was Vatican II and Pope John Paul II that gave them the independence to become more Eastern as they are today. And for the most part, I'm seeing them as a stepping stone to Orthodoxy, as it was for me, because for most people, they can't make any sense out of them. Eyewitnesses of the time, especially in the 17th and 18th centuries, most of the parishioners had no idea that they were now in a church under Rome. Because there was initially no difference. It was essentially a trick to bring them under Rome without people realizing it. And even to some extent today, the older generation, the older generation that I knew is mostly gone now, was really unaware of what they were and couldn't explain to you why there are two Ukrainian churches in the same town. Regardless, Ukraine is a separate and very beautiful Orthodox tradition that needs to be taken seriously. What happened in 2004 and 2014, the so-called two orange revolutions, as I've termed them, has nothing to do with Ukrainian nationalism. These were cosmopolitan, liberal, pro-EU movements, for the most part, created and financed by the West. When this first happened, I proved it, and now, of course, everyone admits it. How anyone could believe, after what happened to the Ukraine in the 1990s, where most of its economy was liquidated, that therefore they need more of it today, it's got to be under someone else's control. It has very little support. I mean, you still have tremendous pro-Russian thinking in the Western part of the country, because they obviously blame liberalism, and it comes from the West, for the complete disintegration of a very highly educated and motivated nation. Now, I'm going to dispense with the discussions about what the borders should be, whether it should include places like Kharkiv, or to what extent did the Cossack Hetmanate, match today's Ukraine. Today's Ukraine is largely a Soviet creation. That's a separate issue, and it doesn't interest me very much. The Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church always had a strong presence in the East, as pro-Russian thinking had a strong presence in the West. So the East-West distinction is overdrawn. As many of you who've been following me a long time realize that I was a huge supporter of the Nova Russia movement and still am. And I want to make a statement here. They do say wonderful things about the Soviet Union, and that confuses people, because you could be reading. I was the first one to translate their stuff into English. And I was very excited. The anti-usury, anti-banking stuff is right in their Declaration of Independence. I mean, they're not kidding about this stuff. And you'll be reading their stuff and say, "Oh, this is great. This is nationalist. This is almost national socialist." Then you'll see, and we have our eternal loyalty to Lenin and Stalin. Where the heck did that come from? And I understand the confusion. Understand that they don't see the Soviet Union as internationalist. They don't see it really even as Marxist. They make a distinction between Leninism, Stalinism on the one hand, and Western cosmopolitan Marxism on the other. I think that's an error. Not to mention the fact that the trauma of the 1990s made the Soviet Union look very, very good. And quite frankly, it was. I'd rather live under Stalin than live in Russia in the 1990s. the death rate was far higher in the latter than the former. And of course, Russia was actually feared under these people. Of course, it wasn't in the 90s and the Chechnya disaster, because the military chain of command had broken down. Everything had broken down. And of course, I call it, in Ukraine, I call it the second ruin, which still hasn't been reversed. In Russia, it's been reversed by Putin, and in Belarus by Lukashenko. The Eurasianist movement in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan had reversed some of it. But in places like Georgia and Ukraine, it continues. And it's unfortunate. So I want to make it very clear that the movement in 2004 and 2014 has no connection with Ukrainian nationalism whatsoever. The older version of the autocephalous Orthodox Church, where you had two groups, the Patriarchate in Kiev under Filaret and the UAOC under Mafodi and his successors. UAOC was far more pro-Russian. In fact, they created two catacomb Orthodox hierarchies. The first was Metropolitan Raphael of Moscow, and the second was Metropolitan Vyacheslav of Moscow. Vyacheslav died a few years ago, and I believe it's Alexei from Minneapolis who took over. And in that group, they have a Western Rite Bishop, Harlambos, who I think is still in Texas. So you certainly can't call them anti-Russian. Now, Filaret, as I've said many times, was KGB, and he admits this. He also was married and has children. I have the letters from his children. He's not divorced or anything. He was a phony. He was part of the KGB moving to destroy the church in Ukraine. He was expecting to be rewarded by being made patriarch of Moscow. He lost by one vote, and then suddenly he became a Ukrainian nationalist, and he is the destroyer that he is today. The divisions in Ukrainian autocephaly come from Filaret. And, of course, nothing has been solved because Constantinople has absolutely no authority. Constantinople is as liberal as anything else. The Constantinople that – and even during under the Turks, which was certainly the case when the Ukrainian hierarchy was reestablished by the Patriarch of Jerusalem in the 17th century. They were both, you know, very weak, corrupted institutions. The Patriarch of Jerusalem was not, however. And of course, the Tomos of 1921, as I've talked about in this show, came from the Patriarch of Antioch, and that created the Orthodox Church of Poland. And they called it the Orthodox Church of Poland, even though it was mostly Ukrainian, to avoid offending the Russians. And they failed to do that. But the church in Poland, then, of course, when the Soviets took it over, they deposed everybody, and then they gave the Poles their own Russian autocephaly. So it's an absolute mess. Patriarch of Constantinople can solve nothing. And the new arrangement, which I will not deal with today, the new arrangement is uninteresting because Constantinople is, like the Church of Rome, an extremely liberal force in the world. Rome and the Patriarch are in communion. They pray together. It was Patriarch Demetrius that removed the Pope, that reinserted the Pope into the diptychs. But thank God we don't have a Pope. Patriarch of Constantinople is a relatively minor figure. Most of his bishops have imaginary cities or underwater cities, non-existent cities as their see, which is not canonical. They don't have many people. Moscow, of course, is the dominant institution. But note, of course, the true Orthodox, whether it be old calendars in Greece or the catacombs, whatever, in Russia and elsewhere, these are large institutions. They're scattered, but they're millions and millions of people. They don't have the external unity, despite an identical faith. But I could say the same of the mainline churches, but reverse. They have no internal unity, but they have the external. But in Orthodoxy, the internal spiritual unity is what matters. Any traditional Orthodox man is my brother. There's no question about that. Grace doesn't come from what bishop you're under. That's not how it works. We're all servants in that respect. Now, what I want to do today, now with that introduction, is talk about one of the great theoreticians, although a relatively secular man, of the Ukrainian national movement. He was a national socialist, a national anarchist in some respects, Ivan Franko. And if you go back to my early shows, 10 years ago, 2009, 2010, I've done at least one show on Ivan Franko, but that was a long time ago. And before I wrote this, and so I want to talk about him again because he is very important. One of my specialties, if not my specialty, is to deal with nationalist theoreticians and writers and politicians from the Orthodox world. Part of the problem with the Ukrainian movement was that they associated Orthodoxy with Imperial St. Petersburg. And as I've been saying since the dawn of, you know, my research agenda here, that St. Petersburg destroyed, or at least attempted to destroy, the Orthodox Church under Peter and Catherine, to the point where, I mean, you have new martyrs of the Petrine yoke, and the Masonic control of the so-called crown in the 18th century reduced the church to almost nothing. St. Arsene Matsievich and Paul of Tobolsk, these guys are essentially new martyrs of the Catherinian yoke. And when St. Arsene Matsievich took his see in Ukraine, he said, there is no church here. There is nothing here. It had been destroyed. Literacy in Ukraine had actually gone down due to the destruction that the Petrine state had and the exploitation. It doesn't mean that everything that they did, the church did, was wrong. They had no canonical authority. It, however, was questionable at the time. And, of course, you know, the anathema of Ivan Mazepa was a joke. Just because bishops say it doesn't mean it's true. Of course, he was never anathematized. These are the same people who said many years to so-called Catherine the First, who was a hooker and whore that Peter the Great took on campaign in Central Europe and then made his quote-unquote queen. But, of course, he had to change the law saying that anyone could become queen then. She wasn't Orthodox. She wasn't anything. She didn't know where she was most of the time. She was so drunk. And yet, you know, she was considered a queen by the so-called bishops. So that's, you know, when the bishops say something, doesn't make it true. She's still in the anathemas today. Not that she's anathematized, but she is seen as the God-fearing monarch. They're listed right in the Sunday of Orthodoxy, including Peter and Catherine. These people who tortured the faith. And I want to say briefly, the concept of recognition is utter nonsense. It is not a category of any significance. It is not a theological category. It's not a moral category. It simply doesn't matter whether a group is recognized by somebody with money. That is not the definition of canonical. I can't believe I have to say this, but that is not the definition of canonical. Because a church is mainstream, because it has a certain amount of money, doesn't make it legitimate. And a recognition of that church has no bearing on anything. If anything, it's the opposite. That is not a canonical category. To be canonical is, shockingly enough, to follow the canons. Or at least the canons that are possible to follow. The dogmatic canons. And it's a precious few groups who actually do that, or at least at the Episcopal level. But as I've said 1,000 times, the episcopacy isn't the church. They have a specific role just like the rest of us do. And they can err just like anybody else. In fact, they err quite a bit. But someone like Ivan Franko, you know, had rejected at least the Petrograd version of Orthodoxy, but he's still heavily influenced by it. Taras Shevchenko, but because he's a Ukrainian nationalist, the Russian Orthodox just simply push him away. And that's a mistake. He was an Orthodox man. But given the time period, you know, using modern Ukrainian was out of the question. My Orthodoxy does come from the use of modern Ukrainian. When I converted, that's who I became a part of. And so I've always had a soft spot for Ukraine. They accepted me. These were Ukrainians from Poland in the Midwest when I was in grad school. Mostly gone now. But those people brought me in. And this is one of the big reasons I do Russo-Ukrainian studies today, is because of the St. George Parish in Nebraska. And that means, you know, those people meant a lot to me. You often have very suspicious Slavs fleeing, you know, the Soviets. It's World War II or afterwards. And, you know, they don't know if they're going to be penetrated by somebody, if someone's going to come in and try to do them harm. And here I was as a kid, some Irish kid in grad school, and they accepted me. And their own children had abandoned them because they were just country bumpkins to these people, despite the fact that these country bumpkins paid off their mortgage, you know, 10 years early and did very, very well on low salaries and raised these kids, not even barely speaking the language, but holding together as an ethnic unity, they were able to succeed and even give money to the underground in Ukraine, which they did on a regular basis throughout the Cold War. Their children, of course, abandoned them, but they wanted to become good Americans. So they get into sports and pornography and debt and, you know, jobs that kill them and everything else. That was, you know, becoming a good American. And it hurt them very badly. And here I come. And it took a little while, but they accepted me very much. You go to a Slavic church, remember, at first it's going to be cold. And it's not their fault. You know, they're used to, especially the older crowd, they're used to having to worry about external subversion. I mean, there were bishops that were consecrated secretly because it was expected that the bishops in exile would be murdered. And that's how bad it was. So at first, it takes a while. You can't go a couple of times and say, oh, they don't like me. That's not how it works. You have to ingratiate yourself with them. You have to prove that you belong there. And it's because of this history that they're like that. And I get emails all the time. I get far more emails than I could ever answer. But I get emails all the time about this. You have to be very careful. And converts, you know, often end up being very brash and arrogant and, you know, or, you know, again, they have the whole country bumpkin mentality that these people are just immigrants. If you show them respect and learn the language a little bit, you'll realize that pretty soon they'll accept you. I even had a key I was on the parish council, believe it or not. I had a key to the church. I learned all the Ukrainian curse words because that's usually what they did in their parish meetings. That's kind of a thing with them. Poor priest. God. Talk about Soboprovna, my lord. So that's just an aside. Now, Ivan Franko. I don't even remember what I talked about 10 years ago when I did my first show on him. The stuff that I'm going to be dealing with now come from the book, Ukrainian National, which will be out very soon. I will have a link, and I'm sure my friends at Sven will have a link to be able to buy it when it comes out. It should be very, very soon. So it's going to be quite different, but still based on the same ideological formulation in my interpretation of Ivan Franko. Franko was a late 19th, early 20th century Ukrainian national anarchist, national socialist of a sort. He was a poet, a playwright, and an excellent national theoretician. And I like the phrase, you know, national anarchist with him because he truly believed that the only kind of socialism worthwhile was one that comes directly from labor, which is something that Marxism vehemently rejected. And talking about our own mission, he says it's a 1906, the poem is called The Righteous Man. Some of these are my translations, some of them aren't. And here's the key passage. He says, Blessed is the man who goes where evil reigns and raises there his voice for truth, who fearlessly accuses a lawless one and torments their mind with the truth. Blessed is the man who, in dark days, when even the most courageous souls cower in fear, will with his voice rouse the sleeping people, and then before their eyes boldly speak the truth. If there's ever, you know, a poem that deals with what we do every day, it's that. We don't do what we do because we have some abstract right to freedom of speech. I mean, that's necessary, obviously. But that's not why we do this. I don't make an appeal on that ground. At least not as a matter of course. We're speaking the truth. We're right. We have a tendency to win in debates, which is why these people don't normally want to debate us. Our enemies are, and the real reason it comes down to the fact that they don't really know us very well. You know, those of us who went to college and grad school, we know them inside and out. We know their best arguments. They only know us through caricature, through mockery. They've never really sat down with our material and tried to understand what we're all about, or precious few of them. So in any kind of debate with the left, we hit them with all kinds of things that they've never even heard before. And ultimately, all they do is simply export their stereotypes onto us. Now, Franco called himself a socialist. Well, you know, to some extent I do too. So did Solzhenitsyn. So did Dostoevsky. It is not Marxism. It has nothing to do with materialism. It has nothing to do with collectivization. And I despise the fact that Marxism, materialism, socialism, they're all used interchangeably. Even historians use them interchangeably. Socialism, in its true sense, is neither Marxism nor materialism. And frankly, as you produce far better, more interesting concepts, they use against liberal individualism, which is called capitalism, than Marx ever put out. In Frankl's work, socialism does not need a powerful state or even a state at all at a certain point. Now, anarchy, you know, is something that exists as an ideal, especially for small ethnic groups. There's no way getting out of it. The state is necessary for protection. There's simply no getting out of it. But the national anarchist idea puts the nation first. This is the blueprint that any state has to follow to the extent that it's necessary. And it's certainly not materialist. You know, many, many times I've gone through, as Solzhenitsyn did, how capitalism and communism are identical. You know, they're both materialists. They're both secular. They both believe that they've solved the problem of history. They both believe that happiness comes from production and consumption. They both, believe that science is in the Enlightenment, that they're the ultimate expression of these things, and that this is what human beings are. They're both Promethean. The socialist theories before Marxism were overwhelmingly Christian and idealist. The church fathers, where we would call them today, idealists and socialists, you know, to the point where even St. Ambrose rejected private property entirely. And normally you had, you know, a decentralized communitarian socialism. And to try to associate that with Marx and Lenin is an absolute travesty. So using the word socialist is a problem. Socialism and communism not only aren't similar, they're often opposites. You know, the collective is not a community. But the simple axiom that any socialist has to maintain is that since production is social, the ability to produce any object is a social event. Therefore, its product is a social event. You know, the egotist is considered heroic in capitalism. He takes his profits not just from labor, but he takes his profits from an entire civilization without which his deluded ego could never exist. It's a contradiction. You know, family, education, tradition, moral example, language, previous scientific thought, these have been developing since ancient times. And they're all needed, taken together, for even the most insignificant notion to be considered. All social, everything is social. Because all education, action, understanding is mediated by the community. Through language, infrastructure, division of labor, and thousands of other less significant variables that permit a society to concern itself with science at all. Individualism is a contradiction. Because if the individualist is going to defend individualism, he has to use concepts and arguments that are created by the collective, by the community, that are by the nation, really. And it can only be understood because we're part of the nation. So in defending, I mean, they didn't create the English language, they didn't create logic, they didn't create, all of this comes from the collective. The individual is a bourgeois myth. It comes directly from industrialization. There's no such thing as self-created. Self-creation is one of the watchwords of demonists. Civilizations create the infrastructure for all thinking, all science, all development, because all is based on cooperation. Well, cooperation is based on having a common culture and language, at a minimum. Nations are not collections of random people, because random people don't live together, well, except in America. But these are specifically national, and by national, I mean linguistic. Franco writes, "In international issues, including socialism, healthy organic shoots can grow in every land only in unmistakably national soil, and only then will they cease to be theory and become a blossoming reality." Now again, when Franco's talking about the state, he's talking about the empire. He's not talking about the state as such. He's not talking about an institution that protects its people. He's talking about an empire that's not even Russian in his day, or Austrian, depending on which side of Ukraine you live on. He's talking about a cosmopolitan empire that completely rejects the nation as such. So the state and socialism for Franco are opposites. You see, the state as an abstraction isn't essentially changed if its ideology changed. Because any ruling class needs a bureaucracy and coercive institutions for even the smallest thing. This was the problem with the First International. Marx was a totalitarian. The early socialists and non-Marxian socialists vehemently rejected. That's why he threw out the Proudhonists. That's why he threw out Bakunin. And Bakunin, as you know, reacted by saying that Karl Marx and the First International is being financed by the Rothschilds. Come across any anarchists, make sure they know that. Their hero, their founder, said that socialism comes, or socialism in the Marxian sense, comes straight from the Rothschilds. And he knew this for an absolute fact. And this is why his version, I mean, socialism is old as civilization is. It's an ancient doctrine. It's taken many forms. So why did Marx's version become dominant? And Bakunin will tell you it's because of the Rothschild family. And we know what happened in the USSR. Centralized forms of communism were created by elite financial forces because they guaranteed that the economy can be controlled from one place, which is the dream of every banker, every financier, every terrorist, and every tyrant. But like most socialists, Franco believed that there's a close relation between the development of classes and the state. Now, there's certain, you know, evolutionary psychology here, which I've rejected for a long time. Evolutionary psychology requires Hobbes' state of nature to function. There has to be a period of time where there is no law or authority or religion or even language. There can't be anything conventional for these instincts that they talk about all the time to develop. Because if there's conventional morality, then the instincts don't make much sense. Because their whole theory is that as civilization develops, the instincts from this mysterious state of nature are less and less important. But authority is always needed. But it doesn't necessarily have to take the form of coercive power. Whether it be, you know, the traditionalists of Western Europe or the Slavophiles of the East, the minute law has to be imposed by force as a matter of course, you've already lost the battle. But the creation of bureaucracy was necessitated by mass production. The state itself, for Franco, is a mass organization of resources taken from others. Again, he's referring to these cosmopolitan empires, not the state as such. And of course, under Bolshevism, it would take the wealth of all. Franco predicted the rise of Bolshevism, and he predicted that it would be merely a massive transfer of wealth to that class calling themselves professional revolutionaries. They then need enemies and ideologies to consolidate their own legitimacy, but what ruling ideology it is doesn't really matter. Men are naturally social, but they're not naturally political. Coercive institutions, empires, the sort that Franco's talking about, are a means by which the neurotic seek to justify their control. These are not communities. These are not nations, because community has to be national, or at least be taken from the national, or else you can never communicate. The struggle for existence creates communities. They create rituals, ceremonies, beliefs, and they recapitulate its own history. And as they become more complex, they soon devolve into a professional class that maintains a history and symbolic understanding of these people. But Franco sees this problem. Now, those of you who know your Oswald Spengler know what I'm talking about. They see the negative element as important in this same chaos creates justification for state power and centralization. So to use Spengler's language, it helps them transfer a community or a culture, becoming a civilization. And for Spengler, civilization is a bad thing. A culture is not. A culture is not a bad thing. But this is an argument for the ancient origins of the nation. But absolute power, as capital has in the West, will soon destroy the original community as the state absorbs all the forces that in fact created it. Now, it's a simplistic scheme, but it's worth talking about. Now, the priesthood is often a check on the power of the ruler. It's often forgotten. In Byzantium, every heretical movement was supported by the emperors, and the Orthodox were persecuted. Yet the faith prevailed, showing that this was never imposed by the state, as the ignorant might believe. Every one of the great heresies favored state power in one form or another. The Darwinian law of struggle removed the unfit, as they would say. This is the colonial idea of modernity, whether in the natural order or the economic one. The positivist school, I mean, Franco, when he was young, embraced positivism. Charles Darwin had the backing of industry, and he came into existence as a way for capital to justify their dominance. But we're not talking about that here. In the ancient world, the Orthodox faith was almost always persecuted by the Byzantine state through heretical emperors. Every heresy, because it separated man from God, allowed the state to have an autonomous realm that doesn't have to listen to anybody. The priesthood is always a check on, as the monasteries were, as everything else was, a check on the ruling class. Darwin came from the battle against this. But it, you know, capital, industrial capital, I should say, and the colonial empires that they necessitated, very different than those previous, needed justification. It was never a religious justification. It was a secular one. But a positivist can't accept any system, let alone something as dogmatic as Darwinism. He realized that those two things were contradictory. So his youthful enthusiasm kind of collapsed when he realized that people like Herbert Spencer were using it to justify capitalism in the British Empire that protected and enforced it. There's two poems, The Hired Hand and The Pioneers, which I talk about in my book, It's Worthwhile, that expand on these concepts. The Hired Hand came out in 1876. They're both in the same era. The Ukrainian nationalist movement was strictly agrarian, like most national movements are. He was himself a son of the peasants, and he had the authority to write in this tongue. The hired hand begins, the hired worker, he doesn't own his own land, which is what he's hired. I mean, remember, in this era, to have a job in our sense is to be unfree. If you don't work for yourself, by definition, you're unfree. To not own your own land, not own your own tools, means that you're dependent on someone else and therefore unfree. He says, for from the cradle he has lived beneath fortune's frown, his life but labor bleak. The hired hand is oppressed. But then the verbiage changes. He says, wherever his plowshare passes, it turns the fertile earth upon the rolling field, which speedily will bring the wavering rye to birth. The soil its fruit will yield. So he goes from something negative to very positive very quickly. The virtues of the hired hand, the life has been described. He is the farmer and responsible for feeding the people. If he's tilling the land, then he should own it. According to John Locke, that's the very definition of ownership. He takes the so-called raw material of nature and creates what's needed for life. It's significant that he's close to natural law, because God has built this into the material order. This is how God rules, through laws that he, in fact, has created. The rolling field certainly isn't depressing, but depicts the landscape of Ukraine, which right in the flag, you know, the red and blue, blue and yellow. The yellow is the wheat, and blue is the sky. It's an agrarian flag just by itself. He's not just a laborer, he's a midwife. He can make the landscape bring forth what humanity needs through God's own law. But the reality of life reasserts itself. Franco says, why does he, like a beggar, wear a tattered cloak? He's but a hired hand, born a servant, once glorified as a free man by the heroes of his folk, in wretchedness now, with no escape, in misery, he now bows beneath the yoke, his life, his liberty, his strength he sells for a crust of bread, which adds nothing to his strength and scarce his hunger quells. That's not my translation. This is the core of the poem. Franco takes note of the Ukrainian national idea of the land as the yeoman nation, which is distinct from the northern Russian idea. The story exists no more where Catherine and Petersburg destroyed Ukrainian independence. The worker's life is based on exploitation. He rents himself out for food. He has no freedom at all. He owns nothing but his own body. And really, he doesn't own that. To not be a slave is simply a formality. From the old Cossack liberty and prosperity, the modern economy has forced the hired hand to something that can only be called de facto slavery. But even in slavery, the master needs to take care of his slaves, just like a farmer has to take care of his tractor, or they're of no use to him. But in modernity, even this modicum of care is gone, and the so-called free labor, the freedom is the owner. He now just works for a wage and owns absolutely nothing. He doesn't earn enough to quell his hunger. He writes, let him but see the earth which his hands cultivate. A harvest brings to birth, though 'twill not be his hands that shall appropriate God's blessing on the earth. Only the owner benefits from the misery of the so-called free worker. Serfdom was far superior. When he's writing this, serfdom had been abolished for over a decade. The reforms of Alexander II just substituted, at least as far as the owner is concerned, one form of misery for another. The distant borderland of the empire. The free laborer makes a mockery of itself, since it implies that the job was taken freely. I mean, Russians serfdom prior to Peter the Great. Everything changed when it became a westernized society in Petersburg. Prior to that, simply guaranteed land to the commune, which is all that a farmer cares about. Subsistence agriculture is not a poor way to live. Subsistence means you have all you need. And of course, they worked a lot less than moderns do. They had a far superior way of life than most moderns do. But calling them free, because now there's no master to take care of them anymore, And of course, they had to be taken care of, just like a farmer has to take care of his tractor. If a tractor misbehaves, he doesn't smash the bits. It's ridiculous. But then there's a shift in mood here. And he says, a better lot it seeks through long centuries, and it still waits in vain, surviving devastation, Tartar miseries, serfdom's toil and pain, for in that heart, however a bitter fate may mock, eternal hope still dwells. As oftentimes from a cliff of granite rock, a living fountain wells, as in a golden haze, a magic fairy tale sees its future gleam, and day by day endures its gloomy, sore travail through one unending dream. It's not an accident that Franco spent some time on the life of St. Ivan Vyshensky, who was actually canonized in between the point I wrote this book and now. Ivan Vyshensky, the Ukrainian national anarchist from Athos. The difference between serfdom in Ukraine and Russia was that many of the serfs in Ukraine were not born serfs. I've dealt with this elsewhere, the Treaty of Andrusovo and the smashing of the Haidamak rebellion and all that. You have to go back to that to get it. But if you're born a serf in difficult land, difficult climate like much of Russia, it's legitimate and it makes a lot of sense. In Ukraine, it isn't. You had somewhat of a yeoman tradition in Ukraine. And the commune wasn't as powerful. That just means that serfdom had to be imposed rather than as a dependency, as an inevitability. So the peasant, what he's saying here, is suffered through foreign domination, unrewarding labor, famine, persecution, and now, the worst of all, a proletarian dependency. The one thing that Marx said that makes a lot of sense is that as classes change throughout history, it gets to the point where you have many classes in the ancient world, and in his mind, only two in the modern. Now, that's crazily simplistic. But what he's trying to say is, the battle lines are drawn very clearly in modernity versus 200 years earlier. Because a proletarian life is worse than any other life. There were many virtues and benefits in the Middle Ages. I'm a medievalist, as everyone knows. That was a secure life. Well, Franco says, plow on, O giant, that when chains of ignorance and toil, thy chains will someday fall. Evil that remains, no more shall thee despoil. Even when the foe's overwhelmed, not vainly hast thou sung the spirit's moral power. Not in vain have been thy tales told in thy people's tongue of victories coming out. As I overcome in time the crusted ills of yore, then on thine own freed soil, thou shalt as owner plow, so that once be more master of thy own toil. This isn't collectivization. He's talking about actual private property here. Something that modern liberalism and capitalism seem to reject. If you till it, it should be yours. Nationalist governments throughout the world, from Peru to Venezuela to Russia, have instituted these reforms. If you till it, it's yours. Liberalism is supposed to be based on John Locke's idea that ownership comes from taking something from its natural state, which in his mind means valueless state, which is a shame, but for the sake of argument, taking it from its natural state and making it into something valuable. If you do that, that means you own it. Now, there's even problems with that, but that's what liberalism is supposed to be based on, and of course it is not. Liberalism is at war with private property. Capitalism and the free market have nothing in common. The free market is largely mythical. Perfect competition in Adam Smith is like his state of nature. It's a hypothetical situation where you have buyers and sellers who all know each other and who have perfect information of each other. You know, prices don't change. You know, it's a non-historical, it's a very simplistic idea. But we do know that markets have a role. You know, especially when it comes to dictating prices and qualities and everything else. But that's not capitalism. Capitalism creates markets, doesn't respond to it. But the poem calls the landless laborer a giant because of their great numbers. They suffer partially because of the feudal regime, whether Russian or Polish, but also because the masters themselves are ignorant. And he believes, and he was wrong to believe this, but revolutionary winds blowing in Central Europe, the landless will have access to land. He took these people at their word, and he shouldn't have. The revolutionaries, they were 1848 or 72, any of this, none of these people really believed in this stuff. I mean, nationalism was big, but just as a way to attack empires, not because these people actually accepted it. You know, Kossuth in Hungary is just one example of it, who was a liberal through and through, and a Mason on top of it. But at least the goal was, in Franco's mind, and so much of the agrarian nationalism from, you know, in the Third World as well as in Europe, is that the landless who are willing to work have access to land that is their own or the commune's, that they can cultivate for their own benefit, not for the absentee owners. And remember, Franco associates absentee ownership with the empire. So by 1878, Franco had done time in prison because he was a national socialist of a sort. The hired hand, and you see the same thing in the pioneers. Although I'm seeing now, I'm coming up to my hour here. Let's be clear of what we're talking about. There is no social movement without the folk. And Franco and all the Ukrainian, all nationalists everywhere, if they're worth anything, talk about the organic ethnic entity, especially if they're bound to the soil as workers. And of course, yeah, the Russians could benefit from this too. But in order for any social movement to work, it has to be national. Suffering might lead to dreams of escapism, but those lead to agitation and understanding, which in turn creates victory. Now, equality didn't mean a legal or formal equality. Equality is defined as the sense where there is no element of society that is not involved with creating what is needed for civilized life. The functional categories, maybe a farmer or a priest or a soldier, are identical in the sense that they're necessary for civilized life, although their work is very different. Democracy in the true sense, the rule of the nation, is not the same thing as parliamentarism. For Franco, only what he calls a community of labor, a commonwealth of producers, makes any sense. And I've always been sympathetic to P.J. Proudhon on you know, secular grounds. Productive labor communities, as the Russian commune, as cells of a new world. And Hegel sent to the normal extension of the family. And they're joined together in a coherent whole by the language of the people. These have to be national. The language is understood, remembering, on the broad sense of social norms and cultural imperatives. This is what we mean by social nationalism. The single ideology that, frankly, unfortunately, the West doesn't seem to possess as part of its consciousness at the moment. So workers begin to realize that not only are they put on economically, but they're also part of a race that's quite different from the ruling class. Remember, in Ukraine, the cities were Jewish, German, and Russian to some extent. The farmers were Ukrainian. So now you have even the Polish oligarchs referred to themselves as Sarmatians and the rest as very different from them. They needed to create this racial divide, which probably didn't exist. But you can't really oppress one of your own. You have to create myths. So there's two elements. There's both the ethnic organic movement on the one hand and the economic on the other. The elite's worst fear is the coupling of nationalism and socialism together. So they react by labeling it fascism or something like that, and which is a very, very different ideology. And that's supposed to scare people, so no one will then follow it. Political philosophy is almost completely ignored and despised in the U.S. Americans are a very ahistorical people. History is nothing more than a weapon to use against your opponents and not a discipline in its own right. People like Ivan Franko in the poem, The Hired Hand, I thought I could get to more than that, but, you know, even a couple of lines of his, they speak to exactly what we're doing. His war wasn't against Russians, and he says that over and over again. It was against the abstraction of the westernized empire. This was the problem with Peter. This is why the Slavophiles, Komiakov and Kirisky and Samodin, they all condemned the Petersburg idea because they took Moscow, which was the Orthodox chosen people, as the Byzantium used to be called, New Israel, you know, New Jerusalem, as Kiev used to be called, and made it just another European empire. Cosmopolitan, liberal, arrogant. Liberal, especially when it comes to their behavior. As we all know, the royal court was a place of debauchery. Even though the monarchs in the 19th century were not, they struggled to keep control over these spoiled, arrogant people at court. And by the middle of the 19th century, Petersburg had already fallen to spiritism and numerology and Kabbalah, which, of course, Ivan III had attacked in Novgorod and created the anti-Jewish Judaizing synods under St. Gennadius of Novgorod. So this is what the kind of the social nationalists, or in this case, the national anarchist, defining state in the way that we've defined state, what Franco comes from and what he's talking about here, and how essential it is for us to understand this. Understand the history of political ideas. Don't throw these words around. You know, communist, socialist, Marxist, materialist, evolutionary, nationalist, fascist. Make sure you know exactly what you're talking about and be prepared to define these terms and distinguish these terms one from another when you use them. Because so many of our enemies deliberately equivocate using terms as synonymous when in fact they know that that's not the case. Anyway, by the time I speak to you next week, my book should be out. I'll probably do some more on this topic there. If I feel like it, again, I want to thank my donors, my friends. I've already always said that those who may share a gulag cell with me in the future, you're my brothers, you're my family, you're my friends. I thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.